Cities elsewhere in Cascadia, stay tuned for Parafoggering, and we are going out to you also via KBOO.FM, where you can contribute on our little contribute bar, and I urge you to do so because this is community radio, and it is via KBOO.FM that we go out to the world and all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, As Time Goes By in Shanghai, showing Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. As Time Goes By in Shanghai tells the story of Shanghai's Peace Old Jazz Band, performing together since 1980. Aged between 65 and 87 years, many of them have been playing jazz since the 1940s and have seen the world transform. From the Japanese occupation and the Cultural Revolution to capitalism on overdrive, the band members have seen the many faces of China and withstood government's suspicion of jazz. Again, that's As Time Goes By in Shanghai, Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. I'm Per Fograng, and I'm going to start out with a couple announcements. Last Monday, May 16th, was for the Roma people, was Resistance Day, Romani Resistance Day. And it dates back to 16th of May in 1944, where the Roma people were in concentration camps at the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp, and they were put in a... they call it Zigeuner Lager, the gypsy camps, where men, women, and children are all kept prisoner and worked as slaves and subjected to experiments. And on 16 May, they rebelled. They managed to find weapons in a warehouse, and they fought back against the camp soldiers. So 16th of May was Roma Resistance Day. That was new to me until recently. Coming up Sunday, APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is having a shindig at Middleman Center. At a Sunday, there's going to be a protest. People will gather on Capitol Highway at 3:45. This is going to be a cocktail reception and conversation with Robert Ford, who is a former ambassador to Syria. So they'll be sipping and eating and talking about war and refugees and ISIS. Outside, people will be protesting AIPAC starting at 3:45 Sunday afternoon, going to about 5:45. So those are my two announcements. And now my guest is Pete Dolak, who wrote a very interesting article. He's a blogger. He has a blog called Systemic Disorder, and he's got a recent book called It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, published by Zero Books. And he also wrote a recent article in Counterpunch, Could an Economic Collapse Be in Our Near Future? So, Pete Dolak, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, it's a very interesting topic. You bring up a book that should not be forgotten, even though it was written over 40 years ago, and that is The Limits to Growth. That was published in 1972. And then also 20 years later in 1992, Beyond the Limits was published. So let's talk about that book.
It's an interesting book. guess it's something, you know, I initially one is inclined to say, well, gee, it was over 40 years ago. That's such a long time ago. What could we have to learn from that? But the two authors who wrote that book were pretty far-sighted people. What they did is they decided to look at various environmental and economic parameters, and they ran a bunch of scenarios with the computer technology that they had at the time. Obviously not as sophisticated as now, but you could still do pretty sophisticated stuff. And they ran about 10 different scenarios and, added, subtracted here and there in different things. But they kept coming up with pretty consistent things that, you know, things would go along as they'd be going on for a while and eventually would plateau. And then when the drop-off comes, that the drop-off they predicted would come very quickly. And as it would happen is that turning point where we plateau and get ready to start dropping back would happen in this decade. For them, it was, 40 years ahead, but, here we are in the 2010s. And so what happened is an Australian researcher, Graham Turner, decided to take a look at it and says, well, did this pan out? Is it panning out? How does this stand up? So he published this paper very recently, but I guess he had been studying this for a couple of years, and he went and followed the plots out of it and then overlaid it over the predictions, and it wasn't precisely the same. I mean, that really wouldn't be possible, but it was pretty closely tracked what they thought. So according to Professor Turner's calculations, that the limits to growth is proving to be pretty accurate, and that we're probably seem to be headed for some kind of collapse. Now, again, it's important to realize, and the original authors themselves, and also Professor Turner in his paper, stress, don't take this as a prophecy. Like, yes, this is going to absolutely happen in this precise year, but the trends are unmistakable.
Well, it's interesting because the authors, a team from MIT, I think they said that these are not predictions, but even so, all these things seem to be happening, not quite yet, but coming pretty close, and sort of like the 5 years between now and between 2015 and 2020 seems to be a pretty crucial time.
It would seem so. I think one of the caveats that's come in is the recent boom in fracking and the explosion in natural gases and oil that we've been to the detriment of the environment that we've been experiencing these last few years, and so that'll kind of keep the party going along a little extra longer than it might have otherwise. But what the interesting thing is you can keep this going a little bit more, but then when you hit that turning point, then the downturn turns out to be at least as predicted to be even sharper. So why the collapse predicted by these models may not necessarily, and it appears won't happen just precisely on time. They may happen a few more years, maybe even a decade down the road, that the drop off could actually be even sharper as a result of this extra boost in energy consumption and energy extraction that we've been living through the past decade or so.
Well, I think there's been a lot of hype about this fracking boom because just the way it's done is this is not tapping into some kind of a pool of oil. This is sort of blasting it tiny little droplets out of rock. And they found that the production, maybe the first year of a fracked well, you may get pretty good oil production, but it drops off rather quickly. And so those oil wells do not last long. And so the companies have to keep drilling more and more new wells. Of course, that's expensive. And a lot of them are in debt because they borrowed money to drill these wells. So I guess the fracking boom is fading already. Williston, North Dakota is becoming a boom town. Now it's becoming almost a ghost town, I hear.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're probably going to see some of that in places like Pennsylvania. You know, I mean, here in the Northeast where I'm located, there was a huge battle in New York State. And I think the governor here, Andrew Cuomo, who's, you know, kind of on the model of Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, who they like to call Mayor 1%. So I like to call Andrew Cuomo Governor 1%. But the grassroots pressure was so strong that, you know, it Cuomo realized he had to do something, so he instituted a temporary ban across New York State, and many local jurisdictions had put bans in there, which naturally the oil and gas producers sued, and the New York State court system actually surprisingly upheld that and said, no, they have a right to, you know, they can't regulate it because that's the state's body, that's the state's purview, but, you know, if they want to just outright ban it, they actually have the right to do that. But, of course, right across the border, you're in Pennsylvania where this is going, you know, full bore. And what you just said, that's the dirty secret of this so-called fracking boom, is that it's very temporary. Most of these wells start tapping out within a few years and within a decade, or if not less. That's it. The gas will be gone. And now, of course, the economics for it don't make any sense because, you know, Saudi Arabia and some other countries are pumping out oil as fast as they can. Because in the case of Saudi Arabia, besides whatever geopolitical considerations may be going on, Saudi Arabia is basically a low-cost producer. They can still make money when oil is really low price like this, whereas a lot of other people, certainly people who are engaging in fracking and very expensive types of oil extraction, you know, they can't do it. They can't sustain it. It's not profitable at oil prices where they are. So there's a lot of people who think, you know, maybe what Saudi Arabia is doing is like, well, we'll just drive everybody out of business. Eventually the price will go up and we can make a little money now while we're doing it. You know, who knows? Obviously it's a very opaque country, but, you know, from a raw, you know, brass knuckles capitalist standpoint, it actually kind of makes sense that there's what to doing it. So when you couple that with the fact that the fracking sources dry up very quickly, and, you know, there's just so much gas there, you can get it out, and then that's it. You've destroyed the environment, and, you know, well, hey, no more clean water, but, hey, you had a good job for 4 years. You know, long-term, obviously, this doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, with this, you know, big upsurge we're getting is obviously going to run its course and probably fairly soon.
Well, the interesting thing about Saudi Arabia is that, you know, their drilling costs are very low, but they have a huge budget. You know, because they decided the way to, you know, they have this ruling, I don't know, 7,000 thieving princes run the country, and to keep the people kind of quiet, they give them all sorts of benefits, and those are very costly. So their drilling costs are low, but their budget requires a fairly high oil price. And there was a recent conference in Doha where they were ready to put a cap on oil production, and but then they changed their mind all of a sudden, and there's a little bit of a mystery about it. According to Pepe Escobar, he's a writer who's been covering this for a while, the U.S. threatened Saudi Arabia that they better keep on producing all that oil because the U.S., even though its own fracking companies are going broke, the U.S. is more interested in punishing Russia, which hasn't quite happened, but according to Escobar, the U.S. Threatened Saudi Arabia into keeping this, you know, full-bore pumping in order to destroy Russia.
I imagine the U.S. wants to punish Russia, and they certainly want to punish Venezuela. Obviously, you know, Russia's a little too big for them to do too much more than, you know, harass it with as they can. Venezuela, obviously, they've been doing an all-out attack on the Bolivarian Revolution, you know, since its inception. You know, so I think it's pretty likely. That seems likely to me that the U.S. is putting a squeeze on Saudi Arabia behind closed doors. So again, to what degree it's U.S. pressure to maintain oil levels, production levels, and to what degree Saudi Arabia is just taking kind of a long-term, you know, outlook on what it thinks its long-term interests and what the balance is between those two. It's very opaque. It's very hard to tell. I have a suspicion that Saudi Arabia, when it comes to oil production, tends to keep its own counsel and act in its own interest. And while I wouldn't discount, you know, U.S. arm twisting behind closed doors, and I'm sure that's going on. Again, I would imagine it's probable, and of course none of us really know for sure, that that Saudi Arabia probably is acting more in its interest, more as a result of U.S. arm twisting, however much that is going on. I think the other consideration going on there is the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The two of those countries are really struggling to be kind of top regional dog for the Middle East region. And Iran wants to open up their spigots now that they're being reintegrated into the world capitalist markets. And so I think there's a lot of consideration there from Saudi Arabia's standpoint of, well, wait a minute, if we do that, that might work to Iran's advantage. So I think we may also see, you know, to a degree, Saudi Arabia spiting itself a little bit just to get at Iran. So I think there's multiple things going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's get back to limits to growth. You know, they created a computer model of the global economy, you know, in the best way that they could do in 1972, and they found that so they have all these sort of graphs, and they modeled the industrial output, food and population as all peaking very soon, peaking sometime between 2015 and 2020, and then a decline. Now, that has pretty much come true. In your article on Counterpunch, you have these, I guess they came from that Australian book, where they have the original graphs that from the limits to growth, which are all projected from 1972, but then they overlaid it with the actual figures as they happened in real time since then, and it's really amazing how much they coincide, how much they match the original projections.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I was certainly struck by that, which is why the graphics isn't the highest quality, but I decided, well, I really should include this because it really demonstrates this, you know, very clearly and simply. And indeed, you're correct. It was Graham Turner's paper where I got that graphic from. He is the one who plotted it out and put it in there, and I decided, yeah, this will really make it clear. You know, I guess this is a case where picture or a graph is worth a thousand words, I suppose. So that's the basis on which he says, well, you know, look, this is happening. It's real. You know, again, not that it's necessarily, okay, you know, next year is when it starts dropped off, so next year will drop off. It could be a few years down the road. You know, again, these are not prophecies and they're not intended to be, but nonetheless, you know, the what's happening in real life is adhered very closely, as you just stated, to what these projections say. So, you know, the reasonable conclusion is like, well, okay, maybe we've reached a peak.
They're onto something.
Right. And this is even before we bring in, you know, global warming, which in 1972 was not such a consideration.
Right.
Back in those days, there was even a bit of a debate. Well, are we going to have a new ice age eventually? Is the globe going to warm up? And that was a legitimate scientific controversy back then, obviously long ago solved, and we see it every day with all the crazy weather that's been a lot of parts of the world have been experiencing. I know you in the Northwest have had some very extraordinarily warm spring, and in the Northeast we had an extraordinarily warm winter. So, and of course, we see what's happening in Fort McMurray up around the tar sands. I mean, they're, what, 57 degrees north latitude way up there, and they're having 90-degree days in early May. And it's just extraordinary. So, you know, that's the other part of the scenario I've read, and I've also written a number of articles on this, just basically analyzing the scientific data, being I myself, of course, am not a scientist, but we can see what's going on with our own eyes. I've seen multiple papers at this point, I think four different ones that pretty much say, well, if we stop throwing everything in, all the carbon dioxide and the methane into the atmosphere today, we have already committed ourselves to a 6-meter rise in sea level, just because of everything that we've already thrown in the air as it works its way through the ecosystem. As it gets a lot of this seed is actually absorbed by the oceans and slowly gets released out. That's probably going to take centuries for that to go out. So we're looking at, as the Chinese saying goes, we're looking at very interesting times coming, and I suspect sooner than we wish.
Well, you know, another interesting point about limits to growth was that, they put in different changes. You know, like a lot of people in this country are saying, well, yeah, all we got to do is find more resources and, you know, to keep the growth going. Well, in the limits to growth, they did a computer run where they doubled the resources to see what would happen. And what all it did was it delayed the peaks, not a whole lot, but it delayed the peaks and pushed those peaks a little higher. But then the crash was all the more. So just finding more oil does not do the job. Plus, now we know it does horrible things to the climate.
Right. That's what made it so interesting, because I think they ran 10 different scenarios in their computer models, and again, that's what they kept consistently coming up with, those kinds of results. So that's part of the scary thing here, the fact that we've had this fracking boom, we've had this oil and gas boom, and it looks like it'll push the peak out a little bit, but as you just pointed out, you know, you can delay the peak or make the peak a little bit higher, but then the downslope is all the more steeper. And the way that graph goes, obviously we can't show it on the radio, but, you know, it's a fairly steady uphill and it gets a little plateau. And then, you know, boom, it's almost like a cliff going down. The downhill is a lot more steeper than the uphill is. And again, so, you know, I think things are going to really start going out of control, fairly soon. You know, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, it's possible they'll find, you know, another financial bubble to inflate and push things back a few years. But, you know, I think you see everything around us. I mean, with the global warming crisis, the environmental crisis, hey, we live on a finite planet. You just can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. It just isn't mathematically possible. You see it with, you know, the financialization of the economy, which is kind of the last gap to squeeze all the profits they can out of us before, you know, that's it. There's no more tricks anymore. And all this stuff is coming to a head. The future is not rosy here.
Well, you know, they talk about the business as usual model, and when we think of business as usual, we are talking about capitalism, which is based on basically perpetual growth. And so it seems pretty obvious to me that that capitalism is really doomed. Now, what replaces it is something else, but it's certainly not going to be capitalism as we know it.
I would completely agree with that. The way I look at it is the 21st century, this is the last century of capitalism, because it's just utterly unsustainable. We're just going to, you can't have infinite growth. In fact, you can't even have, the problem with capitalism, not only can you not have a steady state economy, you can't even have slow growth like we've been experiencing, you know, 1%, 2% a year. I once saw a study, and I saw it replicated in the Monthly Review magazine, which is, by the way, a really good source for good, solid, anti-capitalist economics. And what they found is basically that you need about 3 to 3.5% growth yearly just to maintain employment. That's just to stay in place. That if you want to bring down unemployment, you actually have to have growth higher than that. And of course, in recent years, we really haven't seen that. That's the reason for that is simply, you know, grow or die. That's what capitalism boils down to. If you don't grow and do everything you can to grow your profits, including, you know, sticking it to your employees, well, your competitor is going to do that and put you out of business. So the personality of the capitalist doesn't even matter. This is what capitalist competition drives them all to do, whether they want to do it or not. Although mm-hmm. I'm sure not too many of them are dragged along.
We hear about a few, you know, like some shoe guy in Massachusetts or something. But what about debt? You know, I mean, you know, when you have compounding interest, that kind of requires growth too. And I've been thinking about this for quite a while, is that if you don't have growth, how do we pay off the debts? If we don't pay off the debts, then what do? Do we just kind of default on them or declare a moratorium or a jubilee? Or what happens to the economy if debts don't get paid?
That's a really big question. That's a really good question. You know, what do we do about that? You know, probably ultimately some form of debt jubilee is about the only thing that we're going to be able to do, because, you know, if you ain't got it, you can't pay it. And there's so much debt. You know, there's so much debt built into the system that just continually builds up. And, you know, but the problem is, here's the thing. If we just were say, okay, let's just wipe out, you know, let's wipe out everything. You know, a lot of people have their pensions are invested in the stock market.
There we go, yes.
And things like that. So it's just not a simple thing to say, we'll just let the stock market collapse and clap our hands and be done with it. Much as that sounds really nice. Well, what about all those people whose pensions get wiped out if you do that? So everything at this point, financialization has gotten its hands in every aspect of the economy and so tied everybody into all of this that it's no simple matter to try and figure a way out of it. I mean, ultimately, the way out of it is to, you know, abolish capitalism, transcend it, overthrow it, whatever terminology we want to use or whatever that methodology might be, and have a human-based economy, an economy based on human need, and obviously the environment and our animals, et cetera, rather than based on private profit. As long as we have a system based on private profit, needs don't matter. I mean, you know, a need might get filled. That's nice, but that's kind of a happenstance. That's not what this system is designed to do. And what we're all living through, all this era of neoliberalism, this is the logical conclusion of capitalism. This is its logical development, and it's only going to spiral more and more out of control, and we're going to get more and more inequality until we're all so fed up we actually decide to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now I kind of lean towards the Zapatista model, and I think that you know, we see Venezuela collapsing because they, you know, they depended on oil, and they, my suspicion is, I'm trying to find out more about this. They seem to think that they could just go on living off their oil for a long, long time, and I don't think they took enough measures to create a sovereign economy where they didn't have to import stuff. You know, if you have high prices for oil, you can buy anything you need. But if the price plunges, then you can't. And so if you don't have an economy that's self-sustaining, you see what's happening now. I think, of course, then the U.S. aggravates it with its, you know, measures. So it's kind of a shame what's happening in Venezuela.
It is tough to see. What all that you said is certainly true, and I'd add this additional factor. They took political power away from the capitalists, but they left most of the economy in the hands of the capitalists. Mm-hmm. From what I can see, and I'm not an expert on Venezuela. There's many people who know much more than I do. But from what I can see, I see parallels to what happened with the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the 1980s. You know, they took political power away from the local capitalists, but they left most of the economy in the hands of their local capitalists, who, of course, were subservient to the capitalists in the north, particularly the U.S., and that allowed the capitalists to undermine the economy. And I think to a large degree, that's also what you're seeing here. You have this growth of the black market where people buy things, the traders buy things at state-subsidized prices, and they siphon it off and sell it at a higher price, or they just export it to another country because they can get a higher price for it. And all food and other materials that are needed for consumption at home are now not available, and you've created shortages, but these are artificially created shortages mm-hmm. based on speculation and black market activity.
Well, I think that's partly what's happening in Brazil right now, too. But we're kind of at the end of our time. We've been talking with Pete Dolak, who writes a systemic disorder blog. And he's got a book called It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. And he's got a very interesting article in Counterpunch called Could an Economic Collapse Be in Our Near Future? So thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Per.
Well, this is one topic that I've been thinking about, and I think we're going to be doing a lot more reporting on it as it develops. So thank you once again, Pete Dolak. And stay tuned for Air Cascadia, and then on Flashpoints, we're going to have Greg Pallas talking about absentee ballots. So stay tuned. Cable, always something good on KBOO, your radio station.
All righty, it is a minute before 10 o'clock, and it is your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Coming up in 15 minutes, today's Flashpoints, we'll be hearing the Flashpoints Election Protection Bulletin with investigative journalist Greg Pallast, and we feature an excerpt of the multi-part documentary series, Capitalism. At 11 today on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Brian Blanchfield about his book, Proxies, Essays Near Knowing, a collection of 24 single-subject essays on a wide variety of topics. But up next, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, 10 o'clock. Stick around for headlines, interviews, and commentary coming right up. Thank you for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the United States premiere of Liza, 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 produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Join Liza Minnelli at three different stages of her life, often all on stage at the same time with plenty of songs, backstories about the iconic and troubled daughter of Judy Garland, with a bit of dancing and prancing and much humor among the frightening tales of drink, drug abuse, broken legs, strokes, and hip replacements. Again, that's Liza, 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 May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Okay.